We're talking today with a few geniuses, or at least some of the people who just won MacArthur Genius Awards. Concert pianist Jeremy Denk is one of this year's recipients. He recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
Jeremy, you are not only a celebrated pianist, you also have a wonderful gift for writing music in your blog, Think Denk, in various essays you've done for The New Yorker and other places. Is the writing just a fun extra for you, or is it fundamental?
It's hard to say. It started as a kind of accident, but I think it turned into something a little more fundamental. Sometimes in some cases, you know, I'll write an essay on the blog, for example, about a piece that I'm playing, and it will crystallize something about the piece that I sort of knew, but only when I had to put it in a paragraph form that it finally become more real or more truthful. And then I would go back to the piano and play it more like my blog, which is odd. But I think for the most part, the writing is sort of an offshoot of the way that I'd like to approach musical interpretation generally, which is with a lot of association, hopefully with a lot of imagination and surprise, and I guess humor also is a key recurring element of the blog
Which is partly what makes it so fun to read.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah, that's. I mean, I think that humor is a sort of underappreciated and underdiscussed element in much great classical music. A lot of Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, you know, the big three guys that are the sort of defining classical style. Their style is basically built on the style of comic opera, the sort of rhythm of comic opera, which is the quick juxtaposition of seeming opposites. Just like a regular, like a comedian these days would, you mash up two unlikely things.
Well, your recent album pairs the music of Ligeti's Etudes with the last Beethoven sonata. So a 20th century composer with an early 19th century composer. What's the connection between the two?
Well, You probably realize that I wrote a little bit ad nauseum about the possible connections in the liner
notes. You have very extensive liner notes, yes, which are a joy to read.
Well, it's, I guess extenuation and infinity and the possibilities of things basically on the edge. 111 was Beethoven's last sonata. He kind of plunges off the cliff of the past into the future in that sonata in a very profound way, and in two movements, sort of one backward-looking and the second endlessly forward-looking.
It has a very modern sound.
That's right. And I guess that's the essence of the juxtaposition is Beethoven creates a kind of huge journey to infinity in that last sonata. And Ligeti, all these little etudes of his, each of them is like a little bite-sized nugget of infinity. He's very obsessed with these fractals and the possibilities of simple ideas turned into impossibly complex formations.
You have wonderful things to say about the whole business of playing piano etudes. You say there's nothing more perverse than that, given all the possible finger contortions.
Well, anyone who's studied the piano even mildly seriously knows that there are these sort of so-called piano exercises, which are more like torture instruments. Building the muscle mechanisms you need to play the piano well involves these sort of Czerny or Hannon. And Ligeti sort of takes that and he runs with it, and often in very funny ways makes that kind of exercise like eight times harder because he adds another, you know, mind-bending element to it.
Well, give me an example of that.
Well, even the first etude, which I think is, it's only 2.5 minutes long, and I must have spent 300 or 400 hours of my life trying to get it under my fingers. You you know, it's a rhythmic pattern which begins with both hands together. It's a sort of threes and fives, and you play it, and then very shortly into it, the left hand gets one note behind, as if you were a kind of a terrible pianist. He gets one beat further behind and ever further behind them.
So you almost have to think with the two hands separately.
Oh, yes, you do. I mean, it's like, and that of course, is this thing that you do in sort of normal piano exercises all the time. You try to build the sort of independence of the hands, but Ligeti sort of places all that on steroids and goes ape on it.
Like this technical challenge, don't you? I mean, that's my sense, is you're kind of drawn to the sheer demands of virtuosity in some cases.
I guess that I am, which is I have often come to regret in one way or another. But you know, I'm drawn to pieces that are on the edge, and I always thought these Ligeti etudes, you know, and I think a lot of pianists feel this way too. And these pieces are among the greatest things written for the piano recently. And so I was drawn to the music. Unfortunately, the music is the hardest thing, like, ever written, basically. But I just really like it. And there's the element of the demonic, the element of the things that are out of control. But it's also that it makes the piano sound fantastic.
You know what, I love the way you talk about music, and also the way you write about it, is I get the sense you're almost talking back to the composer. I mean, you're kind of having a little argument about the pieces you're playing, and, you know, there's sort of a quarrel there, but obviously a deep love as well.
Right. Yeah, I guess I like to complain about when composers make your life miserable, even though it's, you know, my own choice to play these particular pieces. I guess, you know, Beethoven, Mozart, Schumann, I mean, all these people are in a way, my best friends, because I spend more time with them than almost anyone else. Inevitably, you develop these kind of fraught feelings about them and their music that is a lot like your relationship with your friends.
What I found so fascinating about reading about your history of learning to play and working with various piano teachers is the disciplinary rigor involved. And, I mean, the way you write about it, I mean, there's a fair amount of suffering
Yes.
in that process. But I have the sense that there's something you crave about the suffering. You know, the more it hurts, the better you will play.
Well, there is, I mean, like any, let's say, athlete training, there is something about no pain, no gain. And there are muscles involved, and they need to be calibrated. And there's so many things that pianists have to build in order to be able to play, to be able to translate their idea of music.
I want to ask you about Szabak, your teacher, after you graduated from Oberlin, this Hungarian pianist. What did you learn from him?
Well, it's kind of impossible to sum up, you know, what I learned from him. I mean, in a way, it was like a whole European worldview, a whole different ethos of what music was for and what performing was for. He had this feeling of being a guru, and you felt that the whole practice of playing the piano, after all the exercises and all the juries and the auditions and the competitions and the ratings, that suddenly that playing the piano became sort of a sacred space again. He was very obsessed with finding the truthfulness of each phrase. It's kind of a dangerous word in a way, but I never forget the way he talked about the opening theme of the last movement, kind of what many people might think is a sort of dopey theme of the last movement of this Mozart concerto. And it's a sort of a sing-songy theme. And he showed how each bar of it had a slightly different rhythmic grouping. So that in place of this sort of lump of four bars of dopey theme, you had suddenly an incredible play between rhythmic possibilities. Maybe that's, if I had to sum up, you know, the things that he taught me, that's one of the big ones.
Well, you also write about one particular moment. I think it was early in your work with Szabak. I think maybe you were in a master's class playing, was it a Brahms concerto? And mm-hmm. he asked you to play a particularly difficult passage with your eyes closed.
Indeed.
Can you describe what happened?
it's a big entrance sort of near the beginning of the piece, and I played with this sort of caution and looking at all the notes and making sure. And I, of course, the more that I looked to make sure, the more notes that I missed or the more unconvincing it was musically. And he made me shut my eyes in front of all these people, all the faculty, and imagine in my brain the sort of area of the keyboard that I had to hit. Sort of imagine the F, which was the main note, but also the E next to it and the G flat just above it, the sort of whole topography of the keyboard over there. And he was like, his point was that I knew the piano subconsciously better than I realized. And that rang so true to me when he said that, that I knew that I had hours and so many hours of knowledge. It was like a trust exercise, a musical trust exercise. And this is how I want my piano playing to be. I want it to be trusting and not inimical to the keyboard, but in a way, in very loving relationship to it. So I went to study with him.
So nowadays, how much do you practice on an average day?
It really depends on the extent to which I'm cramming or preparing for something. But I actually went through a period in November and December where I decided to only practice 2 or so hours a day and no more, because I felt that somehow I was getting diminishing returns. And indeed, that period of practicing a little bit less, I felt that my music making was opening up a little bit. If you can really accomplish one thing, one discovery or one improvement in a day of practice, that's quite a lot, in my opinion.
Are you a perfectionist?
Yes, I am, unfortunately.
Do you have to be a perfectionist to be a really good concert pianist?
Of course. It's very demanding and it's very meticulous. There's also other things that go into it. Imagination, obviously, and love for the music. And those things help to make all the other parts more bearable.
Jeremy Denk is a concert pianist, a blogger, and a recipient of a 2013 MacArthur Fellowship, the Genius Award. He spoke with Steve Paulson.